You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
Alfie Moore, a very warm welcome to A Mindful Life. Now, you were born and raised in Sheffield and went on to an engineering apprenticeship in the local steelworks before joining the police. Can you tell me a little bit about what drew you to law enforcement and the subsequent 20 years that you spent as a police officer?
Okay. Morning, Dave. Yes, I started off in the steelworks. I'm from a long line of Alfs who were all engineers, all Sheffield-based, and all went into things like the steelworks. And what drew me to the police was money, really. I was broke. There was a steel strike in the 80s, mm-hmm. followed by a bit of a depression, I guess, in the steel industry. And I was made redundant. And although I'd worked hard for 4 years, took a proper apprenticeship in mechanical engineering, suddenly I was driving a crane on not very much money because that's the only work I could get.
Yeah.
And so that's why I applied for the police. It was one of the few jobs I could walk into with no qualifications, really, mm-hmm. because I don't have any. I know there's a degree entry scheme in place now. But yeah, so I applied for the police, and I guess I always fancied it a little bit in the back of my mind, but I never thought without qualifications. I always thought you'd probably need English and maths on level or some minimum. And it's only when I applied and got in through passing the entrance exam that I thought I'd had a chance, really.
Yeah. Was it what you expected it to be?
Yes and no, really. It was a different times back then. So this was in the late 80s. Mm. And I got sent to training school right upon Dunsmore, the famous where the police college is now. I'm sure you, Dave, also went to a regional training school.
Yeah, Warrington.
Warrington, okay. Well, I went to Warrington too, but that's a different story. But I was that bad. Got backclassed. No, I went to Wrighton, and that was like an army camp, a boot camp.
Yeah, Warrington's similar.
Yeah. And it was march up and down, shout at you. Yes. I guess it was quite a bullying regime. But it was all sold under you'll be disciplined, and you were disciplined.
Yes.
And everybody left with creases in the trousers and the boots, very shiny, and we knew how to take orders. And so there was a lot going on with that system. Obviously, the bullying side was a negative side.
Yeah.
Because you can't have discipline on that level without it feeling like that sometimes.
Yes.
But I think it was a fair trade off, to be honest. I liked the discipline it gave you.
Well, you use the word bullying, and maybe that's something we'll talk about a little bit later because it's very relevant at the moment, isn't it, in the news?
Well, it was just bollocking city, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You just got bollocked for everything.
It was just the way it was.
You just shouted out every day for something because you were a probationer. That's that's how you talk to probationers. If you were the Reagan characters we see on TV from years ago, you know, that's how sergeants and inspectors spoke to probationers, most of them.
I remember one of the first few days there at Bruce at Warrington, you had to call all the teachers and the trainers' staff. I called one of the PTI's staff, and he bawled at me that he wasn't a piece of wood, and I had to do 20 sit-ups.
I can remember my sergeant, one of my early sergeants. I did a spell in the custody suite, which you have to do. So I was custodian for the shift, and so dealing with the prisoners in the cells. And he called me in the next day, and he pulled it used to be a handwritten custody record at that time. And he pulled an entry, and he said, "Where have you put this down?" And I read it, and it said, "Whatever, I've checked on the prisoner and given him a cup of tea or whatever." Yes. And there was something wrong with the entry. And he said, "We don't put that. Where have you put that?" I said, "Well, okay, I didn't. That's not. I didn't put that." And he started shouting at me. He said, "Don't just admit it, and don't this and that and the other." And it just wasn't my signature or anything. I mean, I was in this bizarre situation where I'm thinking, "Well, do I just have this bollocking?" Even though clearly it wasn't even me that wrote it.
Yeah.
And in the end, I just did. I just sat there and said, "Okay, all right, fair enough." And that was the regime.
I was just wondering whether, well, your time in the police, whether you were the shift joker.
Yeah, I guess I've always been like that. I guess ever since I was a child, really, I would say. Because at school, everybody wants to be popular at school. Yes. And I wasn't one of the good-looking boys. And I wasn't one of the clever boys. And so the only other way to get attention really was to be either very naughty, or I opted for funny, really. So so I guess from an early age, I opted for that, which must have been a very pain in the arse for the teachers. I do apologise if any of you are still alive and listening, but yeah, so I did, and I found humour useful throughout my life in various stages.
Now, obviously, in the police, and again, it's a current topic, I suppose, isn't it, about police humour? But it is a really important part of police work, isn't it?
Definitely.
It's tied in with morale and the ability to cope with the trauma that we see, I suppose.
Definitely. Anybody that listens to my shows will know I have that dark sense of humour. I guess I flip from, I guess, childish and avuncular style.
Yes.
But there's just under that surface is that little bit of darkness that creeps in, which I make no apologies for. It's a coping mechanism for people in the police and other emergency services that have seen such terrible things. I mean, you've had a number of years in traffic, Dave, which is something I was never brave enough to do. And these aren't, you know, ordinary roles, or they, you know, walking down roads, picking limbs up and looking for limbs in hedgerows and putting them in a bag. Mm. You can't begin to imagine the mental effects doing things like that have on people. So I think that pressure relief valve that we get with our dark humour, I think it serves a useful purpose. Mm. So I make no apologies for that.
There was some statistic that I've used a few times now in my podcast, is that I think a normal member of the public will have a life-changing experience, say, 3 to 4 times. Like a police officer in a 30-year career will experience somewhere between 600 and 800.
Yeah.
Which is just unimaginable.
It is. It is. But there's a clear distinction, and I'm sure you're going to broach on this later on, but there's a clear distinction between a dark sense of humour and inappropriate stuff. You know, we've seen a lot of this lately, a big inquiry in the Met recently, sexist, racist WhatsApp group comments, misogynistic comments. That's not dark humour. We've gone somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't connect those things. I'm not a fan of punching down.
No.
I've never liked bullies. I've never liked punching down. It's not something I've ever liked, and I don't like it in comedy either.
And I suppose it's a cheap form of humour, isn't it? I suppose. Yeah.
The comedy circuit, you start doing open mics, you get a bit better, you get paid work, and then you go, you turn up, and a lot of these comedy clubs aren't purpose-built comedy clubs. They are just pop-up comedy clubs every Saturday night in nightclubs or wherever, in the back of pubs, for people go out on the pop. And some of those rooms are really difficult rooms to play with drunken, rowdy people. And I see comedians there doing stuff to appease. You could get dragged into that drag hole because you get rewarded for punching down. You know, if you want to go on stage and do jokes about chavs and druggies, and, you know, a certain type of drunken audience may start to lap that up and encourage you to do it.
But you've
got a decision to make. Do I stand there and die on my backside doing what I want to do, or do I try and sacrifice myself to this rowdy audience at all costs? And I don't do that. You know, I prefer to die.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because you're almost sort of selling your own values and aligning yourself with somebody else's. So that's an interesting point you make. Well, that's very nicely brought us on to the fact that you decided to leave the police service and head off into the world of comedy. Was it difficult to give up a guaranteed paid career and go forth into the unknown, I suppose?
Well, it was a gradual process. So I was fortunate. I've been very lucky with the organisation. I'm not one of these grumpy, bitter ex-cops. I've always got a lot of positivity towards the police. They've looked after me. They've given me a wonderful career. And I've always felt supportive of them. And one of the things they did, when the cutback started to come in and they needed to cut their budget, at that time I'd started to stand up, and at that time I'd got somebody who wanted to sign me, a management company in London wanted to sign me. They wanted to take me on tour and take me to the Edinburgh Festival and do all sorts of exciting things. The timing was awful because I'd just passed my inspectors part 1 and 2, which I'd spent a lot of time.
It's hard work.
Studying for, and I'd just been successful. So I was on the list waiting to get promoted to inspector, which would have been a pay rise of, you know, a good jump up in pay and good jump up in pension. and I just needed to keep my head down for the next 10 years and be normal. And, and I had to go home to my poor wife and say, here's the situation. I'm on the list for promotion. She said, oh, that's great. But also I've been contacted by this company. At the same time, I've been contacted by this company in London who want to manage me and want to take me on tour. And so I'm in my 40s at this point. And, oh, you know, bless her, most normal wives at that point would say, don't be too daft, get to work, get your inspector's job, and, you know, you get a nice lump sum and a nice pension in 10 years, and don't be so daft. Never mention this again. But she said, you know, follow your dream, if that's what you want to do.
Oh, bless her.
And so, I mean, I've always had an impulsive side to my nature. She's more risk averse than I, so we're a good mix like that. I was always a gambler. And but the organisation, fortunately, needed to make cuts. Well, not fortunate for them. And they allowed me to take a career break. And so off I went on a career break. And so I got that safety net. So very fortunate for that. And I decided I was going to have a year off. And I was broke after a year. And we were down to the last tin of beans. I went to the Edinburgh Festival. About six people came to see me. Nobody knew who I was, of course. It was time to go back to work. And just at that point, I had a bit of luck and got picked up by BBC Radio 4.
How did that come about?
That came about, that was at the Edinburgh Festival, that started it. I was in a porter cabin in Pleasance car park. These are the sort of big venues I used to play. A porter cabin in Edinburgh in a car park, playing to about eight people. And I was shaking hands with people as they went out of the porter cabin, which didn't take long. And one lady, she said, my name's Alison Vernon-Smith. I'm a producer at BBC. One of the reasons, and it breaks my heart when people are like, let's cancel the BBC. A lot of TV and media stuff now is all cut up by big agencies. Mm. It's all people doing deals in wine bars. Yeah. It's all create. Even with comedy now, we create, manufacture comedians. Like we manufacture pop stars sometimes. They'll get a young, cute guy with big hair and skinny jeans, and they'll sign him up, one of the big companies, about three big companies that work with TV, and then they'll get him on Live at the Apollo, and they'll get him on a panel show, and suddenly they'll build a career.
Yes.
As you would a pop star. There's a lot of that going on. Somebody like me with a face for radio at my age, chubby northerner, you know, that's not going to happen. But the BBC still scout for talent the old-fashioned way. They will rent a flat in Edinburgh, and they'll send about four producers every week for the whole month.
Yes.
Which is not a bad gig for them either. And they'll go up to Edinburgh, they'll take over a flat, four at a time, they'll have a few glasses of wine, and they'll see as many interesting shows, people they've never heard of, as they can, and to see if they can pick up some new talent. And that's what happened to me. And at the time, I was a bit of a tick in the box at the time, because people were complaining about the Oxbridge accents on Radio 4.
Yes.
They were saying, everybody sounds the same, there's not enough regional accents. Yes. And then they walked into my show, thought, we can't understand a word this guy's saying. He'll be perfect. And so she brought her producer the next night. So there's no agents involved in this, none of that. They just wandered in and liked what I did, asked me to pitch a show. But basically, it just sort of evolved. Quite a bit of that was down to producer Alison, because I did an outline, what they call a treatment, which is like a pitch, really, is my idea of how it should go. And it was quite boring. Here's a history of policing or something like that. Yeah. Or here's a topic, burglary. So here's some gags and here's a story about it. Yeah. And here's a, and it was all a bit bland. Bear in mind, I'd got no experience in writing anything. Yeah. And there was a bit I put in the middle. And I said, well, this is just a 1 minute bit or a 90 second bit of just a moral dilemma. Let's say you get to this job, what would you do? And shout at what you're going to do. And I said, well, just put that in just to break the rhythm, because it's a bit boring otherwise. And Alison read this script, which was about 20 pages. And she said, you know that bit in the middle? That's the show. You just need to throw the rest away and just expand that 1 minute for the next 30 minutes. So credit to her. That's what we did. We turned it all into one story with lots of moral dilemmas in.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fascinating because it makes people think, and it also educates people about police work. And unless you're in the job, nobody really knows.
No.
No. The highs and the lows of being a police officer.
No, we learn from, I guess, people's idea of policing. It comes from line of duty, or I nearly said Dave in the pub, but I've got Dave opposite me. But but people, you know, we don't get much good quality fight. I know there's fly-on-the-wall copumentaries, which are, you know, are quite popular for some people, but not everybody watches them. So we form our opinion of what we read in the Daily Mail or you know, what we see on line of duty. And a lot of people don't really know the basics or the difficult everyday real-time decisions that we have to make. So, and the BBC, the Radio 4 ethos is to inform, educate and entertain. You know, so I just need to get some of that more, a bit more of that last bit and write some jokes. But the, but you know, so that falls in with their brief as well, to be honest. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity to engage with people. Because, as you know, Dave, the press is always historically negative towards policing because that's what sells. And I find this very frustrating. I would imagine that for every 10, there's one negative story, I should think, around policing to 10 positive stories in an average day. And yet nobody will ever know about the positive stories because that doesn't sell, you know, so... If you keep printing the negative story all the time, then you get a twisted view of any organisation. And I see that happening more than ever now. Certainly in the last 2.5 years, it's the most negative national press I've ever seen towards policing. And that starts to shift public opinion, you know, perception, more important than reality. And I find that quite frustrating. So for me to have the opportunity to say, well, hang on a minute, let me tell you from the inside what this situation is really like, is I feel very fortunate I've been given that opportunity and I've got a voice to do that, to add a bit of balance.
Yes. Do you remember your first gig that you did?
My first gig was in the Greyhound in Lowth. You've got to pronounce it like that, apparently. Lowth in Lincolnshire. And it was a new act competition. I was the oldest new act in the world. My wife, credit again to my wife, she saw... I like live bands.
Yes.
But she's a bit more cultured than I. She's a posh lady, a bit more cultured than I, and she doesn't like loud things. But she does like live stand-up. And I'd never seen live stand-up. I wasn't, you know, ever supposed to. But she saw it was on somewhere, a stand-up club in a pub, and so she dragged me to that. And I thought, well, this is all right. I like this. And they were having a new act competition. It was a slow thing, whereas they had professional... compares, professional opening act, professional headliner. Yeah. But in the middle, you tend to, in comedy clubs, you have a lot of newer acts in the middle to where they can cut the teeth. And they had 2 10-minute spots. And it was part of an ongoing competition. This promoter had several clubs in the region. And the audience voted one of these two through to the next round.
Right.
And he'd run that at every gig. And I watched and I thought, well, you know, these... You know, they weren't particularly funny. I didn't think these two were. And I remember I'd had a couple of pints of Stella and I turned to my wife and said, well, my briefings are funny. This isn't working. And she said, well, put your name down then, you know. And so I went to see the promoter. I don't know what he thought of me because I've gone up with a few drinks in me and said, can I put my name down for your competition? And he said, okay, do you stand up? I said, well, not yet, but I think... And he was like, oh, says? Not yet, but, you know, yeah, I'll have a go. I said, okay, well, are you sure? Because, you know, you can't tell old jokes, you know, you've got to write your own stuff. Yeah. And I said, well, that's all right, don't worry about that. So I don't know what he thought to me. He thought, what have we got here? But he put my name on the list and he said, well, we're full up. But then he said, somebody's dropped out. It rang a couple of weeks later. Can you be in Louth in Lincolnshire on Thursday night? And I said, yeah. So the next call was to work to book the day off because I was on a late turn. And I just wrote gags. I just wrote gags all day. I kept ringing my wife about work saying, is this funny? Is this funny? And she'd say, leave me alone. I'm at work. And so I just wrote 10 minutes that day. Yeah. And I turned up in this pub in Lincolnshire. And I was petrified.
Yeah.
You know, we've been in some scary situations in the police, but you know that... That walk towards the mic.
Oh, I couldn't do it.
You know, the light on you, the silence, the applause stops, the expectation. Yes. Then you start to speak and you get instant gratification for the right or wrong reasons for whatever you say. And I did, the other guy did his 10 minutes first, and he'd come up from London. He'd travelled all the way from, because it was £1,000, I think, first prize. So it was worth winning this competition. And he'd travelled all the way from London. He'd been going ages. He was very confident. But I think I was fortunate that they didn't particularly like Londoners. So that was his card marked, I think. And then I went on after, and I can't even remember a word I said. Yeah. My wife says now that it was the funniest 10 minutes she'd ever heard from me. And I cannot remember a word. I'd had about 5 pints of Stella because I was petrified. And I just walked on, and I remember the speaker started playing up, and I did about 5 minutes, you know, talking to the speaker. And I can't even remember anything I said. And they voted me through. And so that was, and then the next round of the competition, it was my next gig. So I didn't do anything else in between. I just wrote, and I thought you had to write a different 10 minutes every time.
I was going to ask you if you told the same joke.
Yeah, no, I wrote a different 10 minutes. Only when I got to the final, somebody said to me, you know, you don't have to do a different one. I said, oh, don't you? I didn't know anything. So I kept that quiet and I didn't tell anybody.
Yes.
And I never mentioned policing because I was a bit embarrassed, you know, you know, I might make a fool of myself. So I kept it quiet. And then when I got through the next round and ended up in this final with about 12 people in the final, I thought, I need to get a bit of practice. So then I started to travel about, do some open mic spots with varying levels of success, sometimes talking to myself, walking off to the side of my own footsteps, room full of people that hated me. And I thought, there's nothing, you can drive for 2.5 hours to do a gig and then you drive home without the radio on in total silence while you think, what have I just done? You know, why have I just humiliated myself like that? You know, I've got a proper job. Why did I do that? And then I had to cough the job because the final happened to be in Scunthorpe where I was working. And that's where the final of this new act competition, he decided to do it in Scunthorpe. It was a regional thing. He was all over the Northeast, this guy, but he put the final in Scunthorpe. And so at that point, I had to tell colleagues...
Did you have the nightmare of them all coming to watch you?
Some did, and they, do you know what? They were very, very supportive, and I've found that with police colleagues. I mean, you'll always get some that don't like anybody achieving anything, do they? You know, there's nobody grumpier.
They normally drive the van on the shift, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. There's nobody grumpier or more cynical than coppers. And if they could see you doing well, you know, and you've a chance to escape, and they don't like that one bit, you know. But yeah, I would say that there was a good turnout of police that were very, very supportive. I didn't win the competition, but all the people around me are much more experienced, and I guess that was the first sign that there could be something in it. You know, if I'm sort of walking on the same stage with these people that have been doing it, you know, a while, and I haven't, then there might be something in it for me. This might be something that I could be good at, I thought, in the early stages. That was the first time.
And history has shown that you are. Right?
Well, thank you. There's nothing more subjective than comedy. So I know that some people like what I do, and I'm very grateful that they support me, but there'll be people that hate the sound of me. You get all sorts of criticism, and you get all sorts... Everybody's a critic these days, aren't they? Yeah. You know, everybody's a reviewer. They can all go onto Facebook and give their view, or on Twitter and give their view. When the radio show's been on sometimes, I see these things on social media. Some of them say, oh, that Alfie Moore, it's quite interesting and quite funny what he's saying, but I cannot stand the sound of his voice. you'll read all these things. So I know some performers that never read reviews for that reason, because it would break them. But I just I'm not like that. I'll take the good with the bad.
Been lucky enough to see one of your shows, and you do have a nice touch at the end. I think because of COVID, you've had to cut back a little bit, but you do personally say goodbye to the audience as they leave. And I'm just curious if anybody has given you an opinion that you weren't expecting.
All right, that moves on. That's the trouble is with shaking people's hands. If you've got like 150 seater or something like that, or going up for 200, and you've got a big foyer, that's fine. Any more than that, the bigger rooms, and you create a bit of a bottleneck. And of course, the theatre don't like it because people want to get out.
Yeah.
And you're there shaking hands. And if everybody keeps moving, that's fine. It's a bit like the Royal Variety. Everybody keeps moving. That's fine. But I had one guy, and he wanted to chat. So if anybody says, "Oh, can I have a selfie?" Just stand aside for a minute, and I'll finish greeting people, and then you know we can do that. But this guy, he just started talking to me, And he was wearing a badge, the prostate cancer badge. And he asked me if I'd have had a check. And I said, no, I've not had a check. And he said, well, you need, yeah. And next time you have a medical and have a blood test. And it was being really useful.
Yeah.
I said, oh, that's really good to know. Thank you. But the queue's getting longer and I'm conscious of that. And then he's showing me how to check myself. And that was a bit of a weird moment where he's saying, and it was all the best intention, but I've got this guy telling me how to check for prostate cancer. And
he didn't have a pair of curtains.
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. But that was a memorable one.
I suppose that does nicely bring us on to the subject of comedy. It's a subject that's always made people examine their own views and values, and perhaps comedy can tackle different subjects that perhaps other genres can't. Recent events in both the policing arena and the professional comedy circuit has caused some offence to some people. I'm curious as to where we draw the line and indeed who decides what is offensive.
That's a big question at the minute. I've never known the world so polarised as it is now with the so-called culture wars, wokeism, the label it's been given versus freedom of speech, and really, really interesting times. Worrying times, really. I think we're less open-minded than we have been for a long time. How much of that is a younger generation that want to challenge, and how much of that is social media, really? Obviously, the downside of social media is it's easy to pick the friends around us.
Mm.
We have people that agree with us, that follow us on Facebook. If anybody says something that we don't agree with, it's easy to block them, tell them to get lost and press a button. You know, that's not, doesn't feel very healthy. We're not sort of exchanging views as much as we should be, I think. Well, there's two things you could be referring to. You could be referring to the job stuff that's going on, the WhatsApp groups. There's that example, which is clearly nobody hates bad cops more than good cops.
Mm, quite.
The first thing you've got to do in order to get good quality candidates, and I'll not get on my soapbox at this point. It's easy for me to do that. Theresa May dropped the starting wage for the police, £4,000.
Mm.
That's got to affect the quality of recruits. She also changed pay and conditions, reduced the pension, did different things. Budget cuts, 22,000 cops less. And that meant everybody was working not just harder, but made it impossible to do the job. Everybody got a tray full of work. They couldn't get round to it. A lot of good people left. Now, I don't know about you, but I can never remember in my policing service people leaving. Nobody left. If anybody left, we talked about it for months. Dave's like, I can't believe it. I can't believe it.
What did we do wrong?
We talked about it for months because it was such... And now people in the last several years have been leaving, all lengths of service, experienced officers that we couldn't afford to lose. And the people that leave tend to be the ones that have got something about them because they could create opportunities outside the job.
Mm.
So we've got this pool of reduced, stressed up officers, and we're recruiting people for £4,000 less. So that's a weaker pool to recruit from. Less people are applying. Plus all the negative press, people don't want to join. So again, that's affecting the quality of recruits. And we've almost got this perfect storm at the minute. So it's very, very difficult times. But basically, I would say if pay them well and respect the role, but if they do anything wrong, just hammer them. If they do anything, I would have a rule, whereas if you're in a position of trust, whether that be a police officer, a politician, and you get convicted of a criminal offence, it's just double. Whatever the charging standard, whatever the sentencing guidelines are, just put a times two. If they're a cop, if you don't like it, don't be a cop. If you're a politician, maybe one or two other occupations, just give them double. And I know there's a lot of unprofessional behaviour that's highlighted, but it's a two-way thing, this, in my view. You know, of course, as a public service organisation, the police have to be respectful and engage with the public. That is their job. But it's still a two-way street. Mm. I see some awful, disrespectful behaviour towards police officers. You know, if you're going to be rude and disrespectful and shove a smartphone in their face and start recording them and try and wind them up to get a bite, you know, and then expect a professional, you know, measured response back. That's a really difficult thing to do. Do your bit, you know, respect these officers. As for a measure, like the Jimmy Carr recent example, we can only use the law, really. We can't have a system where people decide that's inappropriate, that's not, you know, we can only use the law. What else can we use as a measure? It's far too dangerous letting people decide you know, what's appropriate. The cancel culture is something that's being mentioned. Some people say that doesn't exist. Some people say, a lot of people from the left say it's a made-up thing by the right, and there's no such thing as cancel culture. And they'll cite people like Jimmy Carr and Louis C.K. and people, comedians like that are doing whatever they do, you know, and they're still doing it. They've not been cancelled. So how much it exists or not at this current time is debatable. There's two measures to a gag from my point of view. If I guess it's like the CPS and our charging standards.
No, don't.
There's two measures. There's the evidential test.
Yes.
That an offence, the evidence has to pass, the evidential test, and there's a public interest test. And I guess it's the same with a gag.
Finally, Alfie, I wonder how important laughter and comedy is in your own life. And do you laugh at your own jokes?
Yeah, I do. I do laugh at my own jokes. People tell me not to do that when I start doing stand-up. If I say something funny, if I've never said it before, or certain lines always make me laugh. And I sometimes have a moment where I just have a giggle. Mm. And people say, oh, you can't do that. You can't do that. I think Billy Connolly used to do it quite a lot.
He's
done all right, hasn't he? You know, so... Yeah. I'm having fun. I'm genuinely having fun when I'm performing.
And I think it's infectious when you see somebody on stage who is genuinely enjoying themselves.
I have a lovely, lovely time. I won't want to be doing anything else. You know, it's when you start doing stand-up, you start to think, okay, I've obviously gone to a bit later, but you start to do stand-up, you start to get paid work. You might get a break on radio. There's other ways to do it. Adam Kay wrote a book and just had a TV show, but you're thinking, okay, then we move on to TV, and then you've made it, and you do a bit of live work, maybe a bit of a tour on the way to that goal. And then you suddenly start to think, well, hang on, actually, this is what I want to do. I want to go around, I want to be a touring comedian, which is what I am, and I want to go around to lovely little rooms like Darwin last night, and I just want to play to some nice people and just have fun.
I was saying, do you think you would lose the magic if you started playing the bigger venues, you know, the 500 plus?
Yeah, I don't know what that limit is. 500 seems okay. I've done them that sort of size, and that seems a nice room. I should imagine once you start to get, you know, bigger, up to a couple of thousand, there's a point when it stops being stand-up. It stops being that everybody, that intense, everybody crowded around you. There's a point that stops. I'm not a fan of arena comedy. I don't think that can be stand-up. I don't understand how it works, because, you know, there's a 2-second delay. I think the comedian can still hear the end of his last joke, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't even understand how the timing works and how people can feel connected.
Yeah.
Big screens, but I just don't get stadium.
Well, you say you like stand-up. I think it's more than that, because, like I said, I've seen one of your shows and you really do get involved with the audience. It really is a two-way thing.
Yeah, that's a beauty. I'm a compulsive writer, really, and I have to be. You know, if whatever Radio 4 keeps investing in me and saying we want another 6 half-hours of, you know, radio record quality,
so
I might be on stage for an hour, and that's edited down to 30 minutes, and I'm writing 6 of them a year. Everyone feels like writing a new Edinburgh show, so I'm writing 6 Edinburgh shows a year, which is like, you know, it's a ridiculous amount of something to do on your own. And so I spend a lot of time doing that. But that suits my personality, because, you know, there's some comedians that are still doing, there's lots on the speaking circuit, and you see their acting, you don't see them for 5 years, and then you see them again, and it's word for word, expression for expression, and they're just reciting.
Yes.
And I just, that wouldn't suit me at all. I want every gig, I like the audience, I want every gig to feel different. I want to be generating material all the time, and I'd get bored very quickly if I did the same thing.
Well, I suppose it gets to the point of you telling the same joke, it stops becoming funny to you.
Yeah.
And therefore the audience can sense that.
Yes, do you know, you've hit a very good point. And it's not really perceptible. I remember I first started recording, so I used to put a little video camera at the back. I started recording to pick up the mistakes and little ticks you've got on stage that you don't realise you're doing, and to improve my performance. I'd have a joke. A joke has a life cycle. I didn't know this, but this is what it proved to me. Whereas you'll try a bit of material, it's very rare that you'll get the timing right or the words right to start with. So you'll keep tweaking and tweaking and tweaking, and maybe after a few months, it peaks, that joke. and you deliver it perfectly, and you still got the glint in your eye, and it's you're still enjoying the gag,
yeah.
and you get the best response. And then after a period of time, the response starts to dip. And I thought exactly that. That must be me bored with a joke now and yeah. not delivering it with the same enthusiasm. And I've watched tapes of me telling the same gag or doing the same routine a year apart, and that one takes a roof off consistently,
yeah.
gets a really good response.
Yeah.
And I watch me performing the same gag, and I can't tell any difference. Every expression, every emphasis, the timing, I can't tell any difference between that delivery, but the audience can. So it's that subtle, it's that yeah. fine that they know I'm bored with it, and I don't even know I'm bored with it yet. I mean, I'm very fortunate, I keep saying with the BBC, but I'm a massive fan of BBC Radio 4 because they let me, they trust me, and they say, you know, write us a new show, and, you know, what you want me to write about, just please yourself, you know. You know, occasionally there's been scripts, because I like to talk about sort of quite dark
yeah.
subject matter. And again, I've got to the point now after six series where the audience, I've got that trust with them. So if I want to talk about a sexual assault, you know, that sounds awful to do that in a comedic way, but actually it's very powerful and it's doable. And I want to talk about mental health.
Yes.
And I want to talk about these things using comedy.
Yes.
It works. But of course, you'd understand the BBC being a bit nervous. So the scripts have gone to the lawyers before and they've gone to the policymaker at the top corridor at the BBC. But they've always come back and said, just do it.
Well, Alfie Moore, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for giving me your time today.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for talking to me, Dave.